This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good afternoon. I'm Carol Christ. I'm the director of the Center for Studies in Higher Education. I'm delighted to welcome you here today for Laura Hamilton's talk. I heard about Laura Hamilton from someone I know. Some of you in the room know Mitchell Stevens, a sociologist at Stanford. And Mitchell said, when I had an early conversation with him, maybe a year and a half ago, he said, "You have to get to know this great faculty member at UC Merced, Laura Hamilton. She's written a really important book called Paying for the Party." So Laura was generous enough to come up in the fall and talk to a seminar the Center for Studies in Higher Education runs, the Gardner Seminar, about this book, which, if you haven't read it, you should read it. It's such a terrific book. It's about the ways in which party culture at big fraternity sorority party culture at big state universities perpetuates inequality in life opportunities after college. And it's a very sobering and important book, I think. And Laura today is going to talk about her new book, which you can buy right on the table out there, about parenting that comes out of that first book, really follows the same students. Laura is an associate professor of sociology at University of California, Merced. Her interests include gender, sexuality, family, education, social class, and mixed research methods. She did her graduate work at Indiana University, and she got her bachelor's degree from DePauw University. So please welcome Laura, and you're in for a treat.
Thank you so much, Carol. It's a delight to be here, and thanks to the Center for Studies in Higher Education for sponsoring my talk. I drove not far. Merced is actually not far. It may be another world, but it is not far from here. So I drove in this morning on a lovely day. I'm excited to share my research with you. As Carol so aptly noted, I am going to be, my talk is largely going to be focused on my most recent book, Parenting to a Degree. Although it is also connected to and related to my first book co-authored with Elizabeth A. Armstrong, which is Paying for the Party. Both of these books, one of the things I've enjoyed is that they've been really successful in engaging audiences beyond sociological audiences. I'm a sociologist. Beyond just people in academia, but also administrators, policymakers, and even parents have been picking up some of the recommendations and advice in the book and acting on it. Both books draw on a longitudinal case study of a large public flagship university. I'm going to refer to it as Midwest U, but to suffice it to say that it looks like a lot of schools currently in the United States. It is not Nebraska. But it could be. It is not the University of Colorado Boulder, but it could be. Or the University of Texas at Austin, University of Iowa, UCSB, USC, Chico State. The list goes on and on. These schools are institutions that promote big-time college sports. They have a large Greek system, a lively party scene. They offer what a lot of Americans refer to as the quintessential college experience. At the heart of the books, and particularly Parenting to a Degree, are interviews with parents, both mothers and fathers. As I found out, you actually have to talk to both mothers and fathers, and I will give some sort of reasons for that as we go through. 59 interviews, they represent 41 women who all started college on the same dormitory floor at the same university at the same time. I knew these women and their parents very, very well. In fact, I was on the floor as an ethnographer when they were moving their daughters into college. So I met many of the parents then, and I was doing the ethnography for the first year of their college experience, and I interviewed them every year through college, and then a year after. I interviewed their parents when they were nearing graduation, which, as it turns out, is a great time to talk to parents about their anxieties. They had many. And I then just recently re-interviewed the women at age 30, which has been very useful because I can kind of see if some of the assumptions that I had made with Elizabeth in my first book or in this book kind of came true. So the families in the sample are homogenous in many different ways, or in many, many ways. They all identified as white. They all identified as U.S. citizens. Most of the parents and their daughters identified as heterosexual. 30 of the 53 women on the floor, there were only 37 unique names, which made it difficult at first to figure out who was who. As it turned out, however, the lack of variation on these other characteristics really helped me to focus in on social class variation. Class was determined by parents' education, income, the residency status of their children, and family structure. And this, the spectrum was big. On one end, there were CFOs, CEOs of major Fortune 500 companies who do actually send their children to schools like Midwest U. This one family owned a private jet, so a lot of wealth. On the other hand, there were families that were seasonal farm workers, road construction workers, unemployed families who were definitely working class. And there were many families in between that range. So let's go ahead and get to the empirical puzzle of the day. So-called helicopters who hover over their college-age children have to be one of the most reviled figures of parenting in the 21st century. Here you can see a representative quote from the Washington Post. "They are needy, anxious, and sometimes plain pesky. And schools at every level are trying to find ways to deal with them. Parents, specifically parents of today's millennial generation, as many educators are discovering, can't let their kids go." They've been described as stunting their children's development, testing the patience of college officials, and creating coddled trophy kids who boomerang back home. So my question, and one of the central questions of the book, is this true? Do involved college parents damage their children and burden universities? So if you look at social science, what can you glean from that? Social science, there's a vast wealth of research from kindergarten to 12th grade about parental investments. And it says that more is better, almost of any kind of parental investment. The more you do for your kids, the better. But that research tends to stop at the college gates. A lot of these large national data sets, for example, just stop asking questions about parents once children hit college. Short of very limited financial information, we know very little about how adults parent in college. And this is sort of partly because college has been imagined as the age of independence, in which youth are just completely removed from their parents, disconnected. However, in my research, I found out that some parents are actually deeply connected with their youth. Today, I'm going to put forth, I'm going to put forth three arguments that are central to this, central to the book. The first is that helicopter parenting is actually a logical response. And this is what a lot of attacks on helicopter parents as bad, annoying, kind of miss. Parents are responding to real structural, economic, and social conditions that have been building for decades. For example, income inequality, as many of you know, has increased. High rates of unemployment and reduced job security make it really hard for youth to start careers, obtain financial security, and form families on their own. At the same time, we've seen the cost of a college education absolutely skyrocket. The bottom two-thirds of the class structure finds it very, very difficult to fund a college education. There's also a greater array of post-secondary options than there were in the past. Types of schools, college majors, types of extracurricular options are diversified, and not all the choices that youth make are good choices. So financial, emotional, and logistical parental support through college and in the transition out of college actually increase the odds of student success. Contrary to popular opinion, involved college parents are actually now somewhat prized by universities. And this may be strange to many of you who are on the front lines dealing with parents who are helicopters, and they can be quite annoying. I know this as a faculty member myself. But they do solve problems. They solve institutional problems that are posed in part by the privatization process. You know, as public funds for higher education dwindle and accountability pressures mount, universities have to look somewhere for support. Parents have been where they are looking, partly. They've been drawn into the labor of producing successful students. They assist with recruitment, advising, psychological support, career development, even student safety. So in doing so, parents also help universities produce institutional standing, reduce their expenses, and create alumni that give a lot of money back, which schools really want. Of course, not all parents can actually afford to offer this kind of support. I argue that class inequities in college experiences and college outcomes result in part by incorporating parents into the form and function of universities. So outsourcing really increases the salience of class background for student success. All right, so those are the arguments I've outlined for you. We're going to go through the data, and we'll see how we end up there. So in order to understand the variety of approaches that parents take to college and how they help their students navigate through college, I realized it was important to look both at social class and look at gender styles, approaches parents take that are associated with their ideas about gender. So for social class, I realized that parents' beliefs about college are rooted in their class assumptions about the primary purpose of college, what it's for, and how long and how much parents should support their students. The other thing I realized is that this was not something that you could simply divide up into upper middle class parents and working class parents. A lot of research on parental involvement does this. It creates sort of a dichotomy. I found that class was really, really complex. For example, you couldn't just look at a parent's current class standing and say, oh, you know, they're currently upper middle class, they parent this way. I found a lot of parents that brought their class background with them. For example, if they grew up on a farm and now they are millionaires, that makes a difference. They don't parent the same way as someone who's come from wealth and landed in wealth as an adult. I also realized that parents' gendered beliefs about women's economic paths to security, which are also, by the way, somewhat linked to class group, were very important. That is, parents parented in particular ways that assumed women's work and family roles that were different depending on their class group. Now, there were three different types of involved parents. There are many. The professional helicopters, which I'm going to talk about all three of these in detail in a second, the pink helicopters and the paramedics. I'm going to contrast them today with the bystanders. There are actually two types of bystanders, but when I can, I'm going to refer to them as a group just for sort of time limitations. Here is a table for you very briefly. I wanted to show you class background, and we're going to talk a little bit about the gender piece of this as well. As you can see, the professional helicopters and the pink helicopters, you have to be at least middle class to do that. And I'll hint at this today, being middle class actually isn't even enough to do it well. The paramedic parents were incredibly interesting to me. I sometimes get the question, well, isn't this just class background, not parenting style? And the way you can separate parenting style and class background is to look at the paramedic parents who come from a variety of class backgrounds and have sort of different outcomes than others. And then bystanders who came from the lower end of the class structure. A lot of these families were lower middle class and working class. All right, so to get started, professional helicopters, they are who the media imagines helicopters to be. They are focused on cultivating career success for their daughters, and they do this in a variety of ways. One way is to offer financial support. And it's not just that they offer financial support. They see it as their duty and responsibility to offer that financial support, which is sort of different and beyond. As this one parent says, it's our responsibility to pay for education. It's our kids' responsibility to go to college. Another thing that they did that was different than other types of helicopters is that they were very focused on holding their children accountable to a particular set of academic standards. And if their children did not get these standards, they would act. The threats had to have teeth. It actually had to mean something. And so this particular parent held their kids at a 3.0 minimum. Sounds low. It's actually not, given the GPAs of the people on the floor that I studied. And they said, you know what, if you start slipping or showing some sort of problems, you either get a student loan, you pay for it, and in some cases they said, we'll pull you from the university. They offered a great deal of academic guidance, very, very detailed. They did not assume that the advisors were sufficient. They said, don't ask your advisor, ask me, because I know better. And this is interesting, but I will say at least at this university where the advisors were advising something to the order of 350 or 400 students a person, actually that's not a bad advice. And they advised them to, they moved them toward majors that they saw would be easy to move into careers after college. Telecommunications and a whole set of majors like telecommunications proved to be very problematic for students who wanted to get jobs, and we're going to get into that in a little bit. So they advised them away from particular sets of majors. They also helped them develop careers starting in high school. They were looking ahead at college. And so Andrea, she's a professor at a small liberal arts school in the Midwest, and her daughter wants to be a dentist. She helped her daughter get all of those pieces in place starting in senior year of high school. She had interviewed people for scholarships. She knew that service was an important part. As it turns out, to go to dental school, your GPA alone is not sufficient. You have to have sort of a broad array of activities, and they're very specific activities. And this gave her daughter a big leg up in admissions to dental school. These parents, however, are not all about just hitting the books. They realize that integration into campus life is one of the key predictors of persistence. So they wanted, when their daughters were not fully sort of involved, they pushed them to be involved. But they helped them moderate that involvement. So the first quote is from a mother who was helping her daughter figure out how to balance the demands of her academic and social life. And she talks about, you know, sometimes you've got to study when your friends are partying, and that's just the reality of it. Her daughter would actually write down the advice her mother gave her, like literally with a pen on paper, so that she knew what she should do. But along with that came a litany of, it was basically like a safe partying guidebook that mothers basically handed down to their daughters. And one of the pieces of advice was, don't funnel, you will die. Don't do the upside down margarita thing where a man usually is pouring tequila in your mouth or some sort of mixed drink and you're like this. You have no control over the amount of alcohol. Don't accept drinks from someone. Only drink beers that haven't been opened. Whole list of advice that actually did prove their daughters were way less likely to experience sexual assault. And this is sort of one piece of this. Of course, this is not advice that a university could ever give to students because it is effectively blaming the victim, right, when it comes from an institution. But it was effective advice from parents. Pink helicopters, I was so thrilled when I put this presentation together to find out that Victoria's Secret had made a pink helicopter for my presentation. It's the first time that I ever thanked my lucky stars for Victoria's Secret. I was so happy. These parents are a different breed of helicopters altogether, and they are interested in producing something very different. So we'll get into a little bit later when I talk about after college what the professional helicopters wanted for their daughters. But the pink helicopters, during college, they wanted their children to have fun. And that was a priority above everything else. And fun came with a lot of things. Fun also builds social networks. And that was actually what they were looking for. They were looking to reproduce class background through network closure. And eventually, for women, this would mean finding men that they could marry that were affluent and would support them, versus the professional helicopters who are looking to partner their daughters with career equals. All right, so if being a professional helicopter is expensive, being a pink helicopter is doubly expensive. These parents provided something to the tune of anywhere between $600 to $1,000 extra a month beyond the cost of room and board, tuition and fees, going home for vacation. This was alcohol, clothing, makeup, things like that. And when I asked them about it, they said, hey, you know, everyone wants the best for their kids. And if you've got the means to do it for them, why wouldn't you? I get that it's spoiling them. I'm okay with that. They were very, very clear about that. I understand that I'm spoiling them, and I'm okay with that. Of course, they were a little bit less okay with that when I thought about the costs of it, but they were okay with it in theory. They were very focused on their children's social life, and this meant Greek life. They insisted that their daughters rushed. And so this mother was very, very angry because her daughter didn't want to rush. And she said, I had the letters. I had a biography. I mailed them to sororities. I had everything in order for her, but she wouldn't do it. She was afraid they were going to strip her down and make fun of her and make her go through hazing. And then what's left out there is I was like, well, did you ever address her concerns? And she said, Natasha, they're not going to do that. But I didn't really know. I thought some things might go on. I said, you need to do this to make new friends. Okay, and this last piece is really important because she thought her daughter was friends with what she called losers. These were kids who were definitely not wealthy. They were skater kids, despite the fact that her parents were wealthy. And so she was really trying to push her to move into this particular realm. They definitely prioritized partying. They really thought the academics would just happen, but partying and the social life and network connections wouldn't. And so when I ask questions like, does your daughter drink and party at college? Parents would say, yes, of course. That's why you go to school. That's what going to college is for. Now, this is different than when I asked professional helicopters if their daughters drank and party. They said, yeah, you know, they do. And I understand that to some degree, but I try to make them safe. So this is a very different response than the response I was getting from professional helicopter. These parents also really, really minimized academics. It took a backseat. This is a quote from parents who didn't know their daughter's major until graduation day when they looked it up in the program. But the ironic thing about it is it wasn't actually kinesiology. That's the funny part. It was something else. Kinesiology was like the school housing their daughter's major. They had gotten confused. It wasn't her real major. Now, this wasn't because they didn't talk. They talked probably 3 to 4 times a day. It's just that academics weren't relevant for them. All right, so moving on to a different set of involved parents, the paramedics. I have to secretly admit that these parents were kind of my favorite, so I'll just say that because I've been accused of that in talks before. So I'll just admit it openly that they are my favorite parents. I hope to be one someday. These parents were focused on building autonomy for their children. And this is a very different focus than either cultivating career success or trying to cultivate fun for your children. This means that you might actually need to let them make some mistakes and that you don't always rescue them unless there's a serious emergency, in which case you get the title paramedics. So they do allow mistakes. They absolutely wanted their children to make small mistakes, because just like learning to climb a tree or learning any sort of skill, you want them to make small mistakes before they're out on the last limb and then it crashes, right? So they wanted them to do things that they would mess up on, and they were okay with that. They were very clear, you know, you don't hover all the time. You wait in the background in your ambulance. They also did things a little different. Instead of doing things for their kids, helicopters were really inclined to just fix something for their children. These parents were inclined to give their children tools to do things, and they were very explicit about that. I mean, my language comes from them. We tried with both of our kids to give them some tools to learn and guidelines to live by, then let them experience some things without hovering over them. Of course, at the same time, we didn't just throw them to the wolves, which is the emergency support that was available. They were alert for emergencies. They looked for red flags. They, you know, some of them really had to, like, physically restrain themselves and kind of hold back and just wait. Is there a red flag? Is there a red flag? How many red flags? Is two enough? Is three enough? And then they would zoom in, right? So they were there. They were waiting. They were watching. And on the financial support piece, this is interesting. It's different than the other involved parents in that they did not sort of issue a complete full ride with all of the pluses and extras. For example, if they were an affluent parent, they held back and said, you want to join a sorority, you pay for it yourself, which is actually expensive. It's something like $3,000. Depending on the sorority, it could be either a semester or a year for the cost of membership. If they were a less affluent parent, they would strategically put money where it would count the most, and it depended on the student in terms of what that would look like. One of the women called it smart money, and I liked that. She's like, they gave me smart money because they gave me stuff that I couldn't screw up. They gave me stuff that went directly towards something that I needed at any given juncture. So those were my involved parents, and I contrast them with bystanders. Bystanders tended to be from less affluent backgrounds, and bystanders describe themselves as always sitting on the sidelines of their daughters' lives. Many of them did actually want to be involved, but they felt like they didn't belong. They felt like outsiders. And part of what created that sense of being an outsider was a limited knowledge of college. And so this mother is talking about her daughter, Amanda. She was so easy to send to college. She did so much of it by herself. I didn't really know, never going to college myself. I didn't know how things worked. So Amanda's mother actually ends up going to college because her daughter encourages her to do it. Her daughter helps her fill out the FAFSA forms. Her daughter supports her by helping her with her homework, right? Which is a sort of a reversal of the parental child involvement. Parents also felt like they just had a lack of guidance, that when they looked at their own experiences, that their own experiences weren't useful in helping their kids. And so this is sort of, I love this particular father. He says, you know, if we were doctors, we'd lead them down the doctor path. If we were attorneys, maybe we'd lead them down that path and know all the ins and outs about it, but we're not. I'm a firefighter. And I told him, you don't really want to be a firefighter. I've done this long enough to know that you don't really want to do this. So for them, they're like, I know what to tell them not to do, but I certainly don't know what to tell them to do. Because of that, they relied a lot on the university. They assumed that the university would offer a great deal of services that would help their children arrive at what they needed. And so they would say, oh, you know, she's going to have these one-on-one meetings with professors and have all of this guidance. And, of course, these are not things that they got. And so this mother's talking about her daughter, Megan. She's like, Megan talks about her classes all the time, the best ones to take, or if I really need this one, or what should I do? So I just say, well, Megan, you can make that decision yourself. Then if you can't, go to someone who's getting paid to do that. There are people there getting paid to help you out. So that's what I would do. And I said, well, did she ever get help, find someone like that? And the mother said, not that I can remember. I don't know, right? So they assumed that this resource would be there, and it tended not to be. So one interesting thing is these parenting styles or approaches did have clear implications for how women did in school. So these are my three involved parents. One thing that I want you to note is the persistence column. There's a high level of persistence and graduation. It's much higher than the average for the university. Professional helicopters and pink helicopters' daughters, 100% of them graduated in 6 years, 100%. So if you want your child to absolutely not drop out of school because you basically won't let them, then you can helicopter them, right? I mean, this was clear. The paramedics' daughters, 85% of them graduated in 6 years. Note that there's a higher four-year because these children knew what they were doing, right? They were clearly going to get through. And then you pick up a little, like one extra or two extra at 6 years. I was telling Carol this earlier. I did a book club with some lawyers, doctors, and finance, like stock markety people in New York. And they looked at this and they're like, Laura, why do you like the paramedics? I see the risk factor. They're like, for us, they're like, you're telling me that out of every, you know, 100 students, you lose 15 if you're a paramedic parent. That's unacceptable to me. They're like, why would you? That's too much of a risk, right? And so there is definitely that clear risk there, right? Then I want you to take a look at the academic record. The paramedics' children had the highest average GPA, and some women had GPAs as high as 3.8, 3.9. Professional helicopters not far behind. The pink helicopters had a 3.0 GPA, and that's being pulled up by one or two outliers. There were quite a few women that had a 2.8, 2.7 in that sort of range. The major component, too, I haven't told you what easy majors are. There are a set of majors that the university offers that are have high average GPAs, and research has suggested that students don't learn as much during in those majors over the course of their time at college. These majors also can be very difficult to translate into jobs, as we'll see later. These are things such as tourism, event planning, communications, sports broadcasting, a bunch of business-light majors that weren't actually in a competitive business school. These are majors that were not as challenging for students to do. And pink helicopters tended to be centrally located in those majors. I told you I was going to talk about these groups together, so I'll give you just briefly the supportive bystanders. The thing that they do is they pay some for college, but they can't provide any other kind of support. But what I want you to note is that particularly for the total bystanders, the very, very low of low rate of graduation. Zero of them graduated in 4 years and only 50% in 6 years. And also the lower GPAs of these students than you saw with the helicopter parents. Many of them also were getting lured into easier majors. So why does this matter? What did any of that mean for women's ability to be economically secure after college? So I want to sort of go through each group and tell you what their lives look like with a quote that was really emblematic of what happened for them. So the professional helicopters, their daughters had success according to plan. And this is how parents talked about it. They're like, she got exactly what we wanted. And so this is Erica's mother talking about how Erica got her job. She's like, I know exactly how Erica found her job. She found it because the School of Business did it. And I knew this about them. I knew the kind of jobs people who went there came out with. Parents don't have to worry because it's all taken care of. I sent an email to one of the advisors saying that you guys have done everything right. You linked employment to student studies. Maybe some people think that isn't what it's about, but it is. It is for parents who spend that kind of money to send their kids to college. And of course, the last line is sort of a bit implying that if you pay for it, you should get that kind of service. So what did Erica's mother do? She ensured that her daughter was in the competitive business school, which is a bit, it sort of tracks students on a completely different channel through the university. They receive all kinds of assistance and help. It's very difficult to get into that program if you don't have a certain kind of high school record and you don't know what you're doing. You can't track in later. And so Erica's parents were like, yeah, we did it. We got her in, we helped her stay in, we got what we wanted, we got what we paid for. This is sort of an exchange, right? And absolutely, professional helicopters, they were doing very well. All but one were in a job requiring a BA or a graduate school, and they were set for future independence and also peer marriages. They were meeting men that were equally credentialed as they were, and they were not sort of opting out in order to eventually step down in their careers. They wanted to keep going. These are future doctors, lawyers, dentists. Okay, what about the paramedics? So their daughters, I had suggested that this parenting style works pretty well. They were very successful too, but in a very different way. So see how paramedics' parents talked about their daughters. My daughters balance their own checkbooks. They pay their own bills. They got good grades. They drive. They can cook a darn good meal. They do their laundry. They're not dependent on us, and I don't want them to be. I'm quite certain that if Debbie and I died in a plane wreck tomorrow, all of our children would fare well. This is very representative of the paramedics' children. They were very internally motivated. They were very sort of holistically capable in many ways. They could do all the things they needed to do. Professional helicopters' daughters' parents were still calling and making doctor's appointments for them, things like that, at the end of year 4 of college. So these children were much more independent. And I mentioned that I've talked to these parents or these daughter, these women at 30, and you can definitely see the difference between paramedics' children and professional helicopters' children. When I talk to professional helicopters, they're seeking my validation. And these are very successful women, dentists making $200,000, $250,000 a year, and they're seeking my validation of how they're doing. And they're also calling their parents frequently and seeking validation. Paramedics' children are very sort of self-motivated and sort of internally motivated. You can see here that there is sort of a lower, and this is, again, the risk factor. It depends on which side of the coin. If you don't want to risk things, that around 60% were in BA requiring jobs or graduate school. The ones that weren't, many of them sort of opted out, like they opted out of college. One of them is the sort of quintessential story of how risks sometimes get too far before you can manage them. She ended up delving very deeply into drugs, selling drugs, going to jail. And so this was a situation where her parents couldn't rescue her soon enough, right? They got there too late. So that can happen. But they were very self-sufficient. All right, so what happened to the pink helicopters? If you are wealthy enough to support your daughter or your son, which I don't know what that variant looks like, but I'm pretty certain there is a very similar variant. If you're wealthy enough to support them after college for like a decade, you are fine, okay? And if you can be certain that they're going to, as one parent, or not just one parent, but this particular quote was from one parent, said she has to marry a millionaire. They were very, very frank about the marriage plans of their daughters. So this is, you know, this is what you have to do. You have to do a lot. So quote one, this is, and they are, by the way, not happy about this. Parents were not thrilled when they realized how much work it was to actually translate this into economic security. So this is one mother who says, you know what, this is what happened with our generation. We worked to support our kids, to give them a better life, and then our kids. It's not that they threw it in our face. We didn't realize that they didn't know any better now. They just figured the funds were unlimited. So they ended up supporting their daughter, sending her to New York, and eventually her daughter got a job making like $30,000 a year. But in New York, for the kind of lifestyle she was trying to live and the kind of men she was trying to meet, that's nothing. So her parents were still supporting her thousands of dollars a month, and it was going to be going on like that for quite a while. The other thing that parents did, almost all of these women got jobs through parental contacts. So as this dad said, you know, I've got some pretty good contacts in some of the fields Hannah wants to go into, so I think she's kind of counting on a lot of my contacts. Indeed, she was. He ended up having to call his friend, who was a friend of another friend, and in the midst of cutting and restructuring, they got her a job making $60,000 right out of college. Her GPA was less than a 3.0. And she had one of, like, a sports broadcasting major or something like that, right? So these are how women got jobs. Now, if you can't do this, it's not going to work, right? So you see this number right there, the 44% in BA requiring jobs. Those are all parents that are upper class or very secure upper middle class. If you are middle class, this is not going to work. If you are upper middle class and drained all of your resources to send your child out of state, that is not going to work either. And these children were set to be dependent on their parents or a spouse for a very long time. Now, our bystanders. Bystanders were very, very bitter at the end of all of this. It was a bit heart-wrenching to talk to them, particularly the parents who had spent some money to help, even though they couldn't do anything else. They felt like they could give money. They were so disappointed with what the university offered their daughters. This father, and this is sort of the emblematic quote, is one of my all-time favorite quotes. He said it was a little deceptive, you know, and what they said and then what they produced. It's kind of like the stuff that works on TV and then you get it home and it doesn't really live up to expectations. This is like the QVC thing where they are selling these products. And I actually know from experience because my mom was sick once and bought a lot of things from QVC when she was on medication. And indeed, they don't live up to what you would expect. And so these parents were very, very crushed. And the reason they were crushed is that their daughters tended to not get what they needed from their school experience. So let's take a look at the supportive bystanders who are paying for college. Their daughters only won wasn't a bachelor requiring job or graduate school after college. These women, even if they graduated, could not translate their jobs into their degrees into a job because their parents didn't have contacts. They couldn't send them to major metropolitan centers where the jobs were available. And they couldn't continue to support them while they were looking for work. And so their daughters were unable to get the kind of jobs they expected. Total bystanders, these were parents that didn't offer any financial support. Many of them didn't necessarily want their children to go to college. They wanted them to join the military or something else. Their children left Midwest U because they couldn't afford to stay there, which was the great irony of this is that they actually did better when they left for a regional campus where there were other students like them who were working, and the majors that they were offered were majors they could translate into degree or into directly into jobs, accounting, teaching, things like that. So the stark differences for women with involved versus uninvolved parents reflect what I call a new family university partnership. Now, as most of us know, during the middle of the 20th century, the state offered universities resources to help families combat marginalization on the basis of race, class, gender. But this productive relationship is pretty much gone. Support for public universities has significantly decreased, and in many cases, they function much like private schools in many ways. So what do you do if you are a university and you need to produce quantifiable outcomes because of all these accountability pressures with fewer resources? You go to parents. You turn to parents for your help, and particularly parents that have time, money, knowledge of the higher education system, and willingness to participate. And it's really interesting. If you look at the literature, administrative literature, student life literature, you see a shift. You see less of the meddling parents and more of the language of a parent-university partnership. It's changing in how people are talking about students. And this reflects colleges recruiting parents into the labor of producing successful students and workers. But there are a lot of costs to this particular arrangement, as you might guess, right? For one, college parenting cuts into adult financial security. These parents are trying to, at the very point that parents are supposed to be saving for their own retirement, they are draining their retirement accounts, they're remortgaging their house, they're taking on other jobs. This is very, very problematic for their own future financial stability. The emotional demands of helicoptering also are very stressful. There's a lot of research about intensive mothering for children who are younger, and it shows that it takes a toll on women's careers and well-being. Well, one thing that I had mentioned is that helicoptering is largely mom's job. Mothers did almost all the helicoptering, and I wouldn't have known this except for when I talked to the men, because mothers talked in this like grand we, and the we meant them, their husbands, but it was really them. When the fathers talk, they're like, oh yeah, she does it all. In fact, she's a bit of a Budinsky. She does too much. And so it was very clear when I talked to the men what was going on. But this is stressful, and the stress of it adds sort of an additional length of strain on women. It also delays adulthood for many youth, as I had mentioned a few times. For the helicopter's parents, what they were effectively doing, and some of the professional helicopters realized this, is putting everything on hold so they could really advance the career development. And then they were like, maybe now we should teach her how to balance a checkbook or call the doctor or do her laundry. But that was a really good strategy for so long, right? It may actually have unintended consequences later to put adulthood on hold for so long. Of course, the biggest costs are in terms of equality. Affluent families are really not the best partners for universities if they're concerned with progressive policies with regards to gender, race, and class. Universities really build and support an infrastructure around a gendered, classist, and racist system, which is the predominantly white Greek system, largely because parents demand it. Not just students, but parents absolutely demand it for their students. So when we think about what kind of organizational structures affluent families demand, you realize that it's pretty problematic to outsource to parents. It, of course, increases the salience of class background for college and career success. So if you see this as a parenting arms race, the people that are going to lose are the people that can't keep up. And the people that can't keep up are people from less privileged class backgrounds. And also, given the extent to which race and class are related, a lot of non-white parents, Latino and Black parents as well. So what are some solutions? In the book, I sort of tease out different possibilities. Ironically, one that I had to address is, you know, let's just, the market. The market's a good solution, right? And I say this because this is the solution I see in the media a lot. For example, there's this sort of what I call consumer reports approach, which is, let's just give parents lots of information about college. Then they can pick the right school for their children, because really there are differences. Some schools have a 20% graduation rate between Pell and non-Pell students. Some schools have zero. But this particular approach tends to benefit parents that already have the resources to take advantage of that information. The other thing I really worry about it is that it suggests that if you make a bad choice, you're just a bad consumer. And so it's easy to tip that back on parents. The other thing are innovations. And so they're talking about, oh, there's going to be all these innovations in higher education that help low-income families. For-profit schools are one of those, and they are particularly predatory. And there's a lot of research coming out now that suggests that it's not worth, in many cases, as much as a high school degree or its equivalent to. And there's lots of loan defaults because it's very difficult to get through these schools. Okay, so I rejected that possibility. Status-based systems. One possibility, you know, everything revolves around the U.S. News and World Report. Schools are desperate to keep and gain their rank in that system. And, of course, the irony of that system is that how schools are ranked is almost entirely based on the students they bring in. It's not really based on at all what they do. And this shocks my students when I spend a while talking to them about this. They're like, oh, my God, really? I'm like, yes, really. UC Merced actually could be better than other schools, depending on what metric you use. And so one of the things I suggested is change the metrics. For example, include things such as funding for low-income students, programming for low-income students, graduation rates for Black students, right? Change the metric. U.S. News and World Report tried to do that. And they weren't successful because a lot of the schools that were very elite refused to report information. And there were so many of them that the U.S. News and Report decided they couldn't do it, right? And I'm like, do it anyway. Just do it. And finally, there's the socialist, a.k.a. Bernie Sanders, I guess, approach now, which is public reinvestment in higher education. You know, it goes without saying there are many countries where this is what is happening. Even in the United States, there have been proposals that have been put forth that suggest that with the money that we currently spend, we could redirect funds to public higher education and provide at least 2 free years of college, if not 4. And those funds would come from, for example, for-profit schools that eat up a ton of governmental dollars and private schools that receive subsidies such as tax exemptions. And so if you redirect that, you could solve a lot. Finally, what can universities do now? So those are big sort of things that could happen, but I've often talked to audiences that want to know, what can we do now? One of the things that people can people particularly in university programming can do is be attentive to class requirements. When there are majors that have requirements that ask students for things that the university does not provide, you are definitely relying on parental resources. A good example of this are internships. There are a number of internships required at Midwest U for graduation. And the school did not do anything substantively to help the students get those internships. And so I had this one working class woman who couldn't get her degree for the longest time because she couldn't find an internship. And finally, her job, she was in Chicago working in a cold calling company. Her boss helped her write that in, right? So anytime you outsource or rely on something that's not offered by the university and it's written into the major, this is particularly problematic. Give parents resources to help. One thing that I was really surprised by, or I sort of thought was really interesting, is how much supportive bystanders wanted to help their children, but they didn't feel like they could. they just didn't know how to be involved in the way that the university recognized as useful. And so there would be a way to sort of potentially reach some bystander parents. Of course, this is, again, just reinforcing the outsourced-to-parents model. Harness the power of peers, and particularly older peers. Universities often age-segregate students, and they don't link students to a valuable resource that they could use. There have been a lot of universities that have been successful with having having first-generation incoming students have a panel with older first-generation students, and simply that intervention by itself has led to higher graduation rates for those particular students. And finally, recruit and reward faculty. That reward part is super important, right? Student relationships with faculty are very, very, very important. We know this. And so some universities I visited have been working on sort of advising groups that follow students all the way through school and link students that come from similar backgrounds to a faculty member from a similar background. These programs have been very successful. Where they have problems is that women and minority faculty members do the most mentoring. And so you absolutely need to pay attention to that and reward. Course releases, money, counted towards tenure, all kinds of things would help with that. And that's it for me. I would love to take questions or comments from anyone.
Thank you for a great talk.
Thanks.
I was really curious. You are mentioning the majors that were good and bad for getting a job, and all of them sounded like the kind of majors that led directly to a career, even the bad ones, like event planning and tourism or something. Did anybody major in the liberal arts at all? And what happened to them?
Yes.
I mean, we're trying to sell that, you know, if you get a liberal arts degree, you will be able to do any job because you can think, speak, work with others, et cetera, evaluate evidence. What happened to the liberal arts majors?
They did fine. Some of them they went into graduate school, actually, many of them. and this is something I try to deal with my students as well. So when I say good and bad, I'm thinking about event planning does lead to a very specific career, but it doesn't unless you have sort of class requirements that aren't offered by the university. So if you Google event planning jobs, they ask for years of experience. They don't actually require a college degree. What they want is someone who has a certain kind of class taste, like they know what an elite wedding should look like. They know all of the designers and how to plan that, and they know the people and how to network that. And so that particular degree, even though it directly leads to a job, it actually doesn't directly lead to a job for a vast majority of people who get that kind of degree. Whereas when you talk about other jobs like accounting and nursing, those actually did. There were liberal arts majors, and they were clustered in the professional helicopters. Professional helicopters did see those majors as valuable for the reasons that you suggest. And they did not hurt their daughters in any way, shape, or form because, of course, those are translatable into a variety of careers, whether it be business or law school, which, you know, a number of them went on to law school. So absolutely, you know, and that's where they were at. The pink helicopters, they did not touch the liberal arts with a 10-foot pole because it was too hard. There was a language requirement. Too much.
I guess I can use the mic. Hi, my name's Nate. I work at the Office of Undergraduate Admissions. I have a two-part question.
Yeah.
One, can you speak on how you came to choose your sample? Mm-hmm. And two, how you chose class and gender as your form of analysis versus mm-hmm. like class, gender, and race?
Yes. Great question. So how the sample was chosen, so this goes back to 2004 when Elizabeth Armstrong and I were planning for paying for the party, and we just got assigned a dorm, and it was the dorm they had available, and it was all women. initially, the project was supposed to be multiple dormitories on multiple campuses, but we quickly realized that that was a lot more than we could even manage. This project is huge. We went a different way. We went sort of very deep and long instead of going sort of broad. And so, yeah, we took what we were given. It turned out to be a very useful dormitory because it was one of the dormitories where around a third of the students were clustered into what we called party dorms, which are sort of feeder dormitories directly into the Greek system. And so that was theoretically really useful for us. We also did focus groups with other groups on campus to get a sense of where that fit in the larger ecology of the campus. Your question about gender and class is an important one. This talk did not focus on race, but there have been a number of papers and ways that we've talked about, you know, these women are also relying on white privilege, and there's a lot of racial dynamics happening behind this that you don't see. For example, just to talk about the Greek system for a brief minute, the historically white fraternities and sororities have buildings. They have property, very expensive property on campus. They have ties to administrators. They have tons and tons of power. It's racial power. And the black fraternities on campus have none of that. They do not have property. They do not have ties to administrators. They do not have any of the kind of organizational power that the historically white frats have. In fact, I was writing this other paper about fraternities. There's a frat pack, like a political action committee with like historically white. I mean, there's a lot of money and power, and it's racial, right? And so we didn't focus on it in this talk, but that is definitely a piece of this story, right? Race is always there and always a part of the story as well.
Hi, thanks for such an interesting talk. So this talk focuses on parents' attitudes and so on. I'm curious how their daughters felt about their parenting styles. Did the daughters of the helicopter parents say, oh, thank God I had this parent, or did some of them resist and resent it?
Yeah, great question. So this was sort of one of the keys to success, was a match between parents and their children. So the closer the match was between parents and their children, the better things went. And that didn't always happen. So, for example, some pink helicopters pushed their daughters to take this sorority approach or to be very involved in Greek life, and their daughters pushed back. Like, this mom was so mad when her daughter didn't rush. So she, you know, I just assumed she would be in the sorority and never questioned she wouldn't be when she missed the deadline to enroll. Her mom lost her mind. And she said, you have goals, right? Right? You know, revealing the extent to which this was a priority for her. So there were definitely children of pink helicopters for whom this was not what they wanted. It's really hard to disentangle this, though, because you have to think, I mean, these parents and children have been living in the same household together for their entire lives. And the sort of parental effects are very powerful. This one mother, for example, talked to me about how when her daughter was a child, her daughter was known for all the, you know, fashionable clothing that she put her in. She's like, I kept her on Ritalin because it kept her small and it kept her in the cute clothes. Yes, you know. And so when I think about this daughter now, who is a fashion plate, and, you know, where that came from, it's really hard to disentangle, like, what had happened over the course of her life with her mother, you know, through that sort of particular parenting relationship. And also the damage there, you know. I felt like a therapist often. And then you also got professional helicopters' daughters who were a little bit more social than their parents wanted them to be. This one turned out okay, because the thing about professional helicopters, they just kept nudging, whoop, you go that way, push you, right back in. And so Erica was very social, she's kind of social, they worried about how she'd do at MSU, but they put her in the business school anyway, and she did fine. So there was these sort of disjunctures. Where it was most problematic is if you're a paramedic parent and you have a child who wants a helicopter, that's a disaster. You cannot have a child who demands a lot from you and not give it, because then you get into situations where they make really, really, really big mistakes and you're not right there because they expect that you're going to be there for them. So the matching part's very important.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk. Yeah. I'm curious to know if you asked the parents their parents' parenting style. So were they helicoptered and then they passed it on to their children? Or was it more of a reactive approach to not being helicoptered and then they in turn did that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I didn't actually realize until sort of a couple interviews in the importance of parents' parents. What I didn't get necessarily were, I didn't get direct sort of parenting style. I got more tell me about growing up is the approach I started to take, because I didn't want to sort of lead them. And so I got a lot of that through those questions. And where it really stood out, like I mentioned earlier, were for paramedics. Paramedics that were on the affluent side of things as adults, almost all of them had grown up on farms or working class. And they said, you know, my grandfather went to the coal mines when he was 13. And, you know, my parents had me working on the farm, you know, barefoot in the winter. And, you know, I don't know to what degree the stories were embellished, but it was very clear that they had had parents that expected them to be more autonomous as children, and that they had carried that with them as they grew up. And so over time, I became very, very aware of just how much parenting is intergenerational, and that, you know, you can't just map it on to current class background, because people bring all of these cultural ideas about parenting with them. And then it also links to, you know, some of these parents had things happen as adults that changed the amount of money they had. So a divorce happens, and you were a helicopter parent, but you aren't anymore. And so, you know, even changes in their adult class status would shift how they would parent. And so I did become increasingly aware of that and capture it by sort of asking them to tell me about their own childhoods.
Yes, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. You managed to make sociology entertaining.
Thank you.
I appreciate, which I've always had difficulty achieving. I wanted to ask about two questions of maybe continuity. Mm-hmm. Do these helicopter folks practice up in high school? Is it start back, you know, or is high school and are high school and college two different, you know, with different resources, so they can't really, they would be frustrated if they tried to do it. Secondly, what about continuity with the past? What about, you know, the young spoiled guy who's going to Harvard just because his dad and maybe his granddad went to Harvard? Mm-hmm. So how does this link up? Because you seem to set us down as if by helicopter in the present, and we go forward. But I'm wondering about these questions of continuity with both the individual parents' past in high school and our collective past as a country. Thank you.
Yes, two great questions. So first, to take the question of continuity in high school. The parents that stayed with the parenting style they had in high school were more successful. Like, they had better outcomes for their group. Let me give you an example. There, and most of them, the professional helicopters, they were already doing that in high school. Some people were professional helicoptering in high school and then quit at college, because the level of resources necessary to do it at college, and you sort of hinted this, it amps the game up. And so actually this sort of kicks out parents with middle class resources from effectively being good helicopter parents, because they tend not to have the kind of capital that they need to do it at the next level. So some of them sort of stepped back at that point, which was kind of problematic for their daughters if they weren't expecting that. On the paramedic side, you had parents, most of them were parenting like this before. There was this great story about these parents that they gave their daughters like a clothing budget when they were in junior high, and they were going to go visit somewhere cold, and she bought a puffy vest because it was, you know, very attractive, but they didn't have a coat. And that was part of the lesson. Like, you didn't buy a coat with your $200. Okay, you know, like, next year we're going to budget it out and we're going to line itemize it, and you're going to do it by yourself, right? So they were, you know, the parents that stuck with the styles across time were more effective. And when they didn't, that's where you could have sometimes a mismatch. Your other question about continuity through time is a very important one. This pink helicoptering thing is not some new style that parents have evolved. For a very long time, very affluent parents have sent their children to college to create social networks, not to be sort of in the books. The notion of a gentleman's see, for example, comes from the notion that, you're a real stand-up gentleman, you are enjoying your life at college, you're not getting an A or B, because that means you're clearly too studious, right? And part of this was because the reproduction of class was through the social networks that you made. You use those social networks to get you further along afterwards, and it's not anything else about college that matters. There's still a significant portion of the population that uses college in this way. It does not matter what their children's GPA is. The only thing they had to do was graduate, and of course build on these networks that their parents wanted them to have. So that's not a new strategy. And when women started going to college, they kind of got incorporated as helpmates and notion of the MRS degree, where you go to college to find a man, evolved. And this is sort of what I call the more modern MRS. You don't go to college to find a man in college. You go to college to get on the track with the men who are going to be wealthy eventually. You move to Chicago with them. You move to New York with them. You hang out with them. You marry the eye banker, the investment banker, right? So it's definitely an old strategy. The professional helicopters is probably the newest of the bunch. And this is also, you can see this with the rise of, you know, what Annette Leroux calls concerted cultivation. This is, you know, 80s, 90s, 2000s, as parents' abilities to ensure that their children are at least as successful as them, if not more, becomes more fraught. You get upper middle class parents freaking out. And that's partially where the professional helicopters are coming from. So that's the newest of the bunch. Mm-hmm.
I had a question about, well, two short ones.
Yeah.
One about, was there a conflict between the parenting styles that the parents wanted to do, or uh-huh. did it often just default, and it sounds like it's, I'm assuming, defaulting to what the mother's choice was in yeah. this, and the dad just sort of went yeah. along with that, helping in that same way. But I'm curious if there's any parent conflicts. The second question was, do they use a similar type of parenting style with their other siblings, or if they had a male that also went to college, is it a different type of professional or a different type of paramedic, but they're using the same thing, or do they use completely different approaches?
Yeah, okay, so those are really good questions. Oh, and I just forgot the first one. Yes, conflict. Got it.
Conflict,
I was thinking about them. I forgot.
Parents.
Yes, so the conflict. There was sometimes conflict. Not as much as you might think, but there were definitely stories of conflict. And it was, if whoever it was that was suggesting more parenting would win out, typically speaking, if you had the resources to do it, and this was usually the mothers. And what happened was, it resulted in men being less involved, perhaps, than they would have been otherwise. So there's an important story here that I didn't emphasize. In paramedic parenting, the mothers and fathers are right there next to each other. They're both active. They're equally as active. It's less involved than helicopters, but the dads have really close ties with their kids. And one thing that was sort of coming out through these interviews is that some of the other fathers who were married to helicopter wives wanted to be paramedics, but because their wives wanted to be helicopters, what they effectively did is they were like, screw it. Like, I can't match you one for one. I refuse to match you one for one. That's your domain now. And so it was kind of interesting to watch that sort of play out in these couples. And that's what they did. They just said, okay, that's what you do. I'll help with car service, and I'll help with, you know, anything related to numbers often, which is very gendered, of course. But the mother won out in that particular approach. And then your other question about siblings. They definitely did parent very similarly, but there were sort of slightly gender differences in the sense that, for example, with the paramedics, with their sons, they were even more paramedics. Like, there was a family, a multimillionaire family, whose son, they sent him to college and told him to go through ROTC. And they were joking. They're like, oh, we kind of would feel bad if he got killed in the war or something like that. But it was really important for us to have him pay for his own college. There's no way they didn't even consider that with their daughter. They wouldn't have considered it with their other daughter. So they were a little bit harder. The professional helicopters, most all of them had daughters. So I didn't really have a good, they had like multiple daughters. I did not have a good comparison. But of course, research is suggesting that despite women's, or maybe this is why women have sort of so much success in education right now, parents are often more involved with their daughters academically than they are with their sons. And this is sort of one explanation for women's continued sort of educational successes that parents are carefully monitoring. For example, like that party advice, they're thinking about, oh my God, my daughter might get raped, but they're not thinking about how they need to advise their son not to be a rapist, right? So I wish I had more. Yeah.
Well, let's
thank Laura once more.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.